Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Sandra Russell, and I'm here with Emily, Nick, and Amanda, and today's topic is educating motivation. So in today's show, we're basically going to discuss the issue of inspiration and motivation in education. We're going to explore what's right and what's going terribly wrong. What's our role as students? How are we empowered? What should teachers be doing? What are good teachers doing? We'll address these issues and questions using constructive criticism, personal experience, and working solutions. So I'm just going to start by kind of talking about our own experience as students. We're all college students, and we all have, you know, similar and different experiences in secondary and elementary and college level education. But so I'll just start by asking what works for you, what has worked for you, and when have you been inspired or moved in a school setting? Anyone can start.
One of my favorite things about, especially in the university setting or college setting, is the freedom of dialogue. Some teachers don't encourage this as much and go through just lecturing, but when the dialogue actually occurs on a subject topic, it creates connection between not only the students but also interacting with the teacher's knowledge. And I think it facilitates good dynamics between the students and the teacher, opposed to just somebody lecturing and giving out information and trying to pour knowledge into my head. I like to interact with people. I don't like to be talked at.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that was really helpful to me.
One thing I was definitely stunned by when I started college was that the number of things that were taboo to talk about in high school weren't in college. And when you hear your professor swear for the first time, it's like, you know, it's a whole new experience. I think that really, like you said, it opens up a lot of doors to have that freedom to explore new things and things that were never exposed to before.
Yeah, I mean, in college you're treated like an adult rather than a child. And I think that has a definite effect on what you're learning. I mean, there's something about feeling like you're important or what you're saying is important,
right,
and you're not just this child with childlike opinions, but rather you're sharing, you know, and partaking in adult conversation, and you feel like that's important. And, you know, I think that inspires motivation.
For sure.
And going back to my days in high school, or, elementary, middle school, I don't feel that – I feel the teachers were afraid to present adult-like information to
right, kids.
They wanted to avoid doing it. And I think that totally undermines the possibilities of what kids can actually engage in. I don't know, that just seems like a huge negative to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Marva Collins, who was one of the first teachers, first African-American teachers in the Chicago schools, she started out in the public school system, was actually kind of ran out of there, and started her own school. And she was with kids that were, the disabled ones or the ones that had cognitive impairments. And she took these kids in and was reading Plato's Republic with them. And it just these kids ended up to go on to be prosperous, went on to law school, even when these kids were told that they were cognitively impaired. And it just goes to show that she entrusted them with, or empowered them with, difficult material and didn't shun them away from difficult tasks and allowed them to explore. And I think that leads on to the whole great aspect of exposure.
Yeah, and I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's an education major, and she was reading a book, Kai Potok's The Chosen, which I dearly love, and I read in high school on my own, but I asked her, I said, would you offer this as something to your students? Would you read this with your students? She said, no, I don't think they could handle it. And I said, are you kidding me? like this book is huge. And I don't think that's the point. I mean, it's not a question of whether or not a person can handle it. It's a question of exposure. And if you introduce it, maybe it'll be something they'll come back to later. And maybe it's something that initially throws them off. They don't fully grasp. But that's not the point. The point is you're giving them something huge, and it's like a bomb. You're going to go off. And that's the cool thing. And I think you're dead on there.
Well, thinking about that and the way the teacher approached that you know the students couldn't handle it, it makes me think of how children, when they're young, they always want to act like adults. They're constantly playing, you know, imaginative games. You know, acting out doctor or veterinarian or whatever it is, always trying to mimic adult-like behaviors. And it's like when you get to college, all of a sudden, you really get to be an adult.
Right.
And now is the time where you can actually partake in that adult conversation that had always been sort of at a distance, and you were never really allowed in. But now you're allowed in, and you feel maybe personally invested in what's going on a little bit more, hopefully. So I think that just feeling like you're involved and that you're important in what's going on in the conversation, I think that's just a motivating aspect in itself. Right. And in an article about motivation, the title being Autonomy and Relatedness as Fundamental to Motivation in Education, there's a quote where they talk, just to give you some insight into what this quote is kind of talking about. Basically, in the intro, they're talking about how originally, years and years ago, when children were in school, they were much more integrated with adult-like functions, and they were sort of entrusted more as adults. They weren't treated as children as much as children are treated as children today. And the quote is, learning traditionally was nested within personal relationships and activities, meaningful within a larger community. And again, that just sort of reinforces the idea of when you get to college, you all of a sudden feel like you are part of that community or that adult conversation or whatever. But there's definitely something behind that personal investment and feeling like you're important.
Yeah, and I think when somebody expects a lot of you out of you, and there's a line. I mean, you don't want to expect too much out of some, or more than someone is able to give, but you want to have the standards high. And when the standards held high, I think people are more likely to try and reach that. I think that's important. That, I mean, that was important in my experience, having professors say, no, look, like you are capable of this up here, and you're hitting near the bottom. And that's really what helped motivate me.
And building on going back to the article, which is from the Journal of Experimental Education, there's this idea of how the modern era of education, the educational system, removes from where it had come from, where people were closely attached with the adults that they were working with, and the material and activities were significant to everyday life, and they had application. Whereas if you go back to your studies, and really any form, even in college, I mean, I think I think UPs are good, but I think if you're a Central Michigan person, UPs are university programs that the university requires you to take to have you get a well-rounded education. But some of these classes just give some really arbitrary information, and it's I think it's counterproductive to actually engaging what a person is interested in. It's more about memorizing facts, and it doesn't have anything to do with an intrinsic desire to learn, and kind of fosters the opposite of. Fosters this whole notion where everybody thinks school is not cool, I guess, to be cliche.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard it, that kids don't enjoy school these days, and that's really too bad.
With the UP thing, being a Central Michigan student myself, I think part of it is being selective with which ones you take, because there are some that have been really beneficial for me. But at this, I think a lot of people come in, and I've heard and I've seen this with, oh, I need to take, you know, I'm just going to take 100-level class UP. So you get these huge lectures, and they're impersonal, and they're not engaging, and it's an easy A. And I think a lot of times that's what happens, and so people aren't getting the exposure they need or aren't getting the...
I just wanted to add something. Sorry if anyone else had anything to say. To keep in keeping with the topic here and the paper that I originally quoted, the motivation paper, which, by the way, was published in the Journal of Experimental Education in fall of 1991, just to give you some more background information. But going in line with that, another quote, children are expected over a number of years to independently develop skills that often have no intrinsic meaning or purpose for them, with the idea that they will later be useful and relevant. And that just goes back to UPs.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, you have to take these UPs because you'll know why later on, but you don't know why now.
Right.
And a lot of times kids are in a math test, and they're like, when am I ever going to use algebra or whatever? Like, seriously, when is this going to come into play? So I think that quote is, you know, the opinion of the author of that paper is definitely sort of in line with the opinions that we're discussing now in terms of intrinsic motivation.
Right.
And if you don't really think that this UP class is important and you really don't see how it's going to benefit you later, when right now is what you're looking at.
Right, right.
So...
yeah, that's a huge problem. I think the question of what does this mean? Like, why is this helpful?
Right. I mean, if you don't feel like what you're doing is important,
it's
why would you want to do
invest
it?
In it?
Where would the motivation come from?
Right.
That's actually a really good question. Yeah. Where would it come from? Where is the motivation to take the UPs?
Right.
It sort of brings you back to the question: what are you here for? Ultimately, what are you in college for?
Emily, I wanted to ask you. I know you went to high school in Minnesota, and you've mentioned that a couple of times in comparison to our experience in Michigan public schools. What were the advantages you feel, or what did you really like about it? I guess it's the best public school system in the country.
Well, I don't know if it's the best, but I know that it's really good. And I realize now, like, that my high school that I graduated from, it was actually voted like number one in the state of Minnesota.
Dang.
So that's kind of, I kind of have a really weird, I guess, not weird, very different perspective on education than a lot of people, because I had a different experience. But earlier I was talking to you guys here about a podcast that we listened to called This American Life, and in it they were talking about education and how, like, in elementary school they had this time where they would read for 30 to 50 minutes a day. And the guy said, this is unusual for public schools. And I'm like, that's unusual? We did that. You know, after recess, we'd go in and read for 30 minutes or longer.
Yeah.
And we would have, I think, a lot of group activities in my elementary school, I remember. But high school was a little bit different. I was only in high school for 2 years, so I guess I'm not really the best person to ask about that. But I feel, I'm not really
sure. Do you want to talk a little about that, the accelerated program you were in? Is that... did you find that helpful? Or?
I found that helpful in that it saves... I went to college my junior year of high school, which is a program that a lot of students back home in Minnesota do, actually. And you get to experience college and receive high school credit as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it was really valuable in that I saved a lot of time and money in college, like an actual college setting. But I feel as though going from my high school, which was number one in the state, to community college was kind of a step down. So my education was actually lowered by going to community college there. So I'm sure that a lot of people have different opinions about it, but I don't know.
Going back to reading time that you received, was there a certain, like, canon that you had to read from? Is there a certain selection that
Not that I remember. I remember just picking up whatever book you were interested in. I mean... you couldn't sit down and read cartoons, but, you know, I remember picking up chapter books and reading whatever I wanted. And I know that that really helps my reading and my writing later on. Like, I think that I'm a pretty strong reader, and I think that I'm an adequate writer. I mean, there's always room for improvement, but I think that that was probably why I'm so passionate about reading now, which is sad that most people in the country don't have that, I guess.
And it, I think it also, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, encourages, like, this whole idea of being able to choose for yourself and being able to kind of gravitate towards what you're interested in.
Right.
And that's what they were saying on This American Life, that the students in this school, Washington Irving Elementary School, I believe, they would just pick up whatever they wanted to read, you know. Some of them were reading horror novels and some were reading, you know, cheesy love stories or whatever.
Kindergarten,
or K through 12 students are into, but I mean,
goosebumps.
You got to read what you wanted to, which was fun. It was a fun break from the normal structured class setting.
And for those of you listening, this is a show called This American Life on NPR. You can access this episode. It's called Two Steps Back on at www.thisamericanlife.org, and just type in This Two Steps Back. It's a great episode, great show. Props to you.
And we will include the link to that episode, actually, on our website.
I think it's already up, actually. Yep, it is. And our website is ethicstalk.cmish.edu.
So if you want to get on that, that's sort of a supplement to our conversation.
Please do.
Going back to, I want to go real quick back to UPs. I kind of started off with a negative connotation about it. But after hearing about Emily's experience about being able to choose and stuff like that, I was thinking about the responsibility of being able to choose a UP.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, I believe it was Sandra who mentioned that a lot of people choose it based on what class will be the easiest and not the most interesting. And it seems like there's a lack of one, responsibility to your own fulfillment and also a focus on external rewards, that being grades, that is what we're after, rather than acquiring some knowledge, which is, again, I believe UPs are a good thing, and I came in here not knowing my major, and after taking a few classes of philosophy, I really became fascinated, and I thought it was, I mean, without the UPs, I don't know if I would have ended up there if I had to choose coming in without knowing.
Something else I think is really interesting, too, is career centers. I know a lot of students opt to go to a career center in high school, and I don't know that all high schools even offer that, but the high school that I went to, there was sort of the availability to attend a career center, which is sort of focused on educating specific areas of work, for lack of a better term. There was business classes offered at the Career Center, criminal justice classes, graphics classes, but basically, you know, those kind of alternative high school or Career Center or Skill Center, whatever you want to call it, they offer more specific, maybe real life type classes and programs. And I actually did attend a Career Center for a couple of years, and I did find it worthwhile. And some people that don't feel like they're traditional college-bound students sometimes get a lot out of something like a career center, because it's not traditional, like, academic education. It's definitely more focused on a trade.
Okay.
So for people that aren't academic-bound and they don't want to just, you know, learn all this academic...
You just want a job.
...classes...
Yeah. It's a good job.
So for some people, that might be a worthy alternative. Yeah. And, you know, some people would also say that they got a lot out of it. And I feel like I definitely got something from it. So that's just kind of an interesting thing, too. Did any of you go to a career center at all?
I think I'd like a technical center.
I went to the same thing.
I went for art. So we just basically did art for 3 hours a day. But there were a lot of different things there. There was like a culinary thing. There was a mechanical part. There's a business part. I mean, there's a lot of different parts of it that are
what I'm talking
about. Yeah, I know what that is. Yeah.
And it's good. Because it's you know, if your high school doesn't have interesting extracurricular activities, it's sort of a nice outlet, and I know a lot of kids at that time were like, excited to go to the career center because they're like, it's a nice break from regular school. They actually let me do what I want.
Right.
I'm interested in, you know, intrinsically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I know that a lot of schools are cutting these extracurricular things and these extra cool classes, but, you know, they're cutting them because they're not getting budgeted for it anymore. They got to keep the core important things. So Career Center is really good in that respect.
Yeah. Well, it just seems like, you know, if what you're ultimately after is to get children or students, high school students, whatever age level, interested in what they're doing, rather than just going through the motions and just doing it because they feel like they have to.
Mm-hmm.
Again, bringing the question up, you know, what are you here for? Like, what are you doing it for? What is this doing for you? What does your education give to you?
Right.
And I think the important way to phrase that question, you know, is to yourself. You know, and I think oftentimes, again, going back to the extrinsic motivation, we don't do things for ourselves. We end up doing them for these outside resources. And we've kind of been dancing around this concept, this episode, but autonomy and how important that is to a student's development to be able to govern themselves and to choose for themselves, create for themselves their education and what they want to fulfill.
Now, I want to talk a little about creativity. I mean, I hear a lot about that amongst teachers and how that plays a role in education. So how do you guys think creativity and allowing both teachers and students to be creative works, and what are the potential outcomes and consequences of this? I mean, is this a good thing? I mean,
it's an interesting question. With my experience, a lot of teachers like to encourage open-ended projects where it's like, hey, choose a topic, you know, and see what you can do with it, you know, and leave it pretty broad. And I at first, it seems like it's overwhelming. I know I'm doing a project right now that I'm trying to narrow down on law and education, and it's still just so broad in my mind, but it's great because it allows me to choose for myself, and I think...
Right.
It develops that creative sense and that dependence on yourself rather than somebody trying to spoon feed you information. You really get to interact with it and choose what you're going to do. And again, back to autonomy and creativity.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in like K through 12 hating the assignments that was like, read this book and write me a report. I hated that. It was not fun at all. And I'm sure that the teachers hate grading it, too, because they're getting the same thing over and over again. So, I think that more open-ended assignments like that are really actually they're kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And just to add to that, going back to what Nick said about assignments that are sort of so broad that sometimes you can almost be stupefied.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here, write your paper on anything, and you're like, oh, what do I do? I have, you know, so maybe... Mm-hmm. The allowing for creativity, but with some guidance. I think that, you know, you still need to be guided as a student, and that makes me think of a school that I've heard of recently that was actually founded by the Blue Man Group, believe it or not. So the Blue Man Group, for those of you who don't know, they're sort of an entertainment industry. They're very creative. They you know, they're painted blue, bald, whatever, and, you know, they have, like, where they beat on drums, and they do all this, like, creative stuff with, like, music and movements, and anyway, so their latest venture is a school that they've founded, and it's called the Blue School, and it's for ages 2, and they've up to first grade now. First grade was recently added, and their whole core values and their program is very creative. I mean, obviously their group as an entertainment in the entertainment industry is very creative, but they've sort of brought that into this school that they founded. And they more, you know, they definitely encourage creativity among the children, but it's sort of guided creativity, sort of give them the tools and let them work with it. Because sometimes somebody can say, you can do whatever you want, but what do I do? Where do I start?
Right.
So I just thought that was really cool that they're focused on that creative outlet to sort of cultivate the interest in a student's own education. And by allowing that creativity, I think it sort of brings you in. It sort of draws you in more, and you sort of take charge of your own learning.
Yeah.
Do they have like a kind of like a methodology? Like I guess I kind of imagine like the Blue Man Group. You know, they're kind of like stomp with a bunch of paint.
Right.
And I'm trying to like imagine what kind of classroom they would kind of depict, and I just imagine like, you know, just like paint all over the walls and like
kids.
Yeah, and like drum sets and like bongos and people like just dancing, which is, you know, sounds like a great time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious if it's just, you know, supplying an atmosphere that's creative and mm-hmm. allowing somebody to go off and play. I mean, I guess I think about a good metaphor is like throw a kid in a room with a bunch of instruments and see what he starts playing and really enjoying. I guess do you know if there's like a method to how they give their creativity off mm-hmm. or guide creativity, or is it more of a broad sense mm-hmm. of creativity?
Well, they definitely focus on their environment. The school itself is just crawling with creative possibilities. For instance, they have a room in their school that they call the Wonder Room. And it's this room that's like padded. Like the floor is padded, the walls are padded, and kids can just go in this room and like jump around and run around and do crazy stuff, you know. And they can actually pull up the cushions on the floor and it's like all lit up. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example of how that they've taken the environment and just made it really creative, like things that pull apart and come apart and light up. And I know that they have a time during the day where they encourage this like shaving cream fight or something like that, where kids like are encouraged to mm-hmm. play with shaving cream and just do whatever. And I think the point of that is that given their target audience is 2 to 1st graders,
right.
What they're doing is they're trying to make learning fun. That's what it really should be about. And so what they're doing is they're allowing this creative time to get really fun, and you know, things like the Wonder Room, and they have like set playtime, but they also have a curriculum too, where they focus on the basics that any other school would focus on. It's just that their approach is different, and the way that they not develop the message, but what do I want to say? The way that they deliver the message they're trying to get across.
Right.
It's just done in a more hands-on, creative way rather than just, you know, lecturing or whatever.
And I think what I perceive in a lot of times, and this is kind of a problem within public schools, there's so much bureaucracy to go through, and there's so much, you're dealing with the administration. That is one thing they were talking about in that episode of This American Life 2 steps back, where the teacher who was implementing creativity and reading and unconventional approaches to education, her struggle was that there was a mandation from the top down saying you cannot do these things, you have to do it this way. And so with a school like the Blue Man Group, the Blue School, they don't have that bureaucracy to deal with. And that's kind of the beauty of charter schools or private schools and even homeschooling. And so, but there are definitely positive and negatives along with those as well.
And going with that of the top guy, I mean, the No Child Left Behind Act, which is basically trying to, I'm slowly doing research on it and finding out about more and more about it, but it's trying to give a nation's report card, and you have to meet these certain requirements that these, you know, that the schools need to live up to a certain standard.
Right.
And I think that applies to charter schools as well. And the thing that lacks is the focus on the affective process or the affective aspect of things. And that's mentioned in the article, Autonomy and Related, and it says fundamental to motivation. I'm just going to read this real quick.
Yeah.
It is concluded that the success of cognitive agendas in educational settings is dependent upon effective processes within the classroom, and that the creation of an optimal classroom climate serves both learning and developmental goals. So first you need to get the affective aspects going. You need to get people internally motivated before they can produce some cognitive, some results on tests. And I think that's really lacking in the No Child Left Behind Act legislation.
Are you talking about like standardized tests or tests like just exams in school?
I'm talking about standardized tests.
Okay. So like ACT, SAT, or MEEP, I think, for Michigan.
Yeah, the MEEP.
So you think that test scores and preparing for tests and things like that go against intrinsic motivation to learn?
I think to a degree, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It really structures it and defines a narrow path upon which somebody should take to getting knowledge.
Right.
And it says that you need to know this in order to move up, you know, or to succeed.
Right.
And I mean, like, I took the ACT, and, you know, I was, you know, I had friends who did phenomenally well, and I had friends who did not so well. And it seemed like there was this great judgment amongst kids between each other and this competition against each other, you know, and kids being really embarrassed about their score or just boasting about their score. And it seems, again, counterproductive to learning and being interested in what you can do.
We have a caller, so we're going to take that now. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hello.
Would you
How
like
are you guys?
To... Good. Would you like to announce yourself?
You know, I call every week. I'm a groupie. And I just wanted to just follow up on the blue school discussion. And this idea of just allowing people to go into a room and play and that sort of thing, I just wanted to, I know that some of you know this, but that's actually, research shows that unstructured play has a very important developmental consequence. And it's been shown that what unstructured play does, and this also connects with Nick's point about dealing with the affective instead of the cognitive, but free play, it's called, actually allows and facilitates the development of something called private speech, which you guys have talked about before.
Right.
And private speech is essential to self-regulation, going back to autonomy. So self-regulation is when the child is, or young adult or whoever, quite frankly, is setting goals for him or herself and then, you know, restraining oneself from doing things that undermine the goal, so sort of staying on target, not being distracted, that sort of thing. And that ability is something that it must be developed and cultivated, and it's shown that free play facilitates the development of private speech and therefore self-regulation. Does anybody know why that is? Because I know that some of you have done a little bit of reading on it. Does anybody know why free play actually leads to self-regulation and private speech?
Well, what I think of, what you're saying actually makes me think of executive function. And
yep.
I've heard before that that children should engage in free play because they're sort of setting their own rules on themselves and adhering to their own rules and guidelines,
right.
which is sort of, in a way, cultivating that executive function, that rational capacity, because they're doing it themselves rather than be told to do it.
Right, and but see, the other really cool thing about free play is that the word free is somewhat misleading,
right.
because it's actually restrained play, but the children themselves are putting the restraints on the play. So, like, if a child plays, for example, whatever, house or doctor, they're assuming certain roles in the society, and those roles have norms associated with them. And so they're sort of voluntarily, like, trying on these norms. And if you watch children play, if somebody, like, starts to behave in a way that's contrary to a doctor or a mother, like, the children will say, no, you're not playing the game right.
Right.
So it's this really nice balance of freedom because they're choosing the role, but then the role is constraining their behavior, and this is considered to be linked to the development of self-regulation because the students are starting to restrain their behavior for the sake of some goal or norm. I also just wanted to say that this idea of unstructured play is mentioned by Plato. I think it's in Book 5 of the Republic, where he talks about education. And he says at the very beginning, once these future guardians have passed all these tests, you want to expose them to disciplines, but not in any specific order. Just let them, you know, gravitate towards what they find interesting, and it's only after they've sort of played with this material that you impose an order on it. And there's many passages in both Plato and Aristotle where they talk about the dangers of compulsion, that when you compel somebody to do something, they forget it doesn't stay with them. And anyway, I just wanted to make it apparent that what the Blue School is doing is something that, you know, the ancients recognized, and we've forgotten for whatever reason, but yeah.
Briefly, I'd like to add, I took care of a little boy who was in Montessori school, and they did this unstructured play thing, and it was amazing the way that this little boy could regulate himself and his emotions and his desires, and compared to other children of his age that I've seen, like, this kid was very motivated, and he could really take care of himself. So, I mean, this unstructured play thing is just getting to be very helpful, I think.
Yeah, people are just starting to look at the developmental consequences of it, and people who do, like, developmental neuroscience are really amazed at how, like, when you do have a classroom where they do have moments of unstructured play and you compare it to a structured classroom, the children are just like night and day in terms of their maturity level. I think also that, I don't know, am I still on?
Yeah.
Okay, because some voice said I'm now off the host queue, but whatever. anyway, I think I lost my train of thought, but
maturity and structure.
People are just starting to notice that it has this developmental consequences, but I think one thing also that it does is that in the child, going back to autonomy, starts to see his or her own agency and is, you know, further motivated by that. There's something that happens developmentally when somebody, like when the person sees themselves doing something, like freely, rather than because somebody told me to do it, that's shown to have pretty profound developmental effects. Mm. And I will just leave it there and keep listening.
Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Yeah, to add to that, I think and in my own experience, the idea of nurturing those things, I think when a child is free to, even a child like through high school and even and as an adult, when you're free to explore those things and in your own interests, and then you have somebody who is nurturing those things and somebody who's investing in those things, that I think that really contributes quite a bit to your own, self-concordance.
Self-worth.
yeah.
I mean, it sounds like also your self-esteem.
Right.
Because as the child, plays and, you know, adheres to its, to his or her own norms or whatever, and maybe is successful at doing whatever it is they're trying to do on their own, it seems like that would only add to self-esteem.
Right. This kind of leads into the next topic of, I just want to talk about exposure. And we mentioned this a little bit earlier, but how does this broaden and encourage a student's self-discovery and interest in that? I mean, I mentioned that for me, it was people noticing what I'm interested in, what I'm really excelling at, and investing in that. Do you guys have your own? Do you have anything to say about your own experience with exposure? At any point, go ahead.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it's really helpful when somebody notices what you're good at and encourages you to pursue that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that enough people have that in their lives.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times classes are so big that, you know, their teachers don't get to realize that, hey, this kid's really good at writing or this kid's really good at math or whatever. And so they don't have that external motivator encouraging them on, which is what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, do you have any specific experience?
Yeah, I mean, talk about your own experience with exposure. Here's a better question. What brought you to philosophy?
Okay. Well, that's easy. Actually, in high school, for me personally, my high school did not have any kind of philosophy classes or anything like that. My high school pretty much had the bare bones, like, here's what you do, and you leave.
Right.
And, it wasn't even until I got into community college that I sort of discovered philosophy any real level.
Mm-hmm.
I took an intro to philosophy class, and just because it sounded interesting to me. Questions were appealing, ethical questions, and other questions as well. And it appealed to me, and I took the class, and I loved the teacher. The teacher was very engaging. I felt like I was personally attaching to the material. The discussions, the whole dynamic of the class was just totally different than what I was used to in high school.
Right.
I mean, obviously, there was a lot more dialogue going on, especially since it's a intro to philosophy class.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was so much more discussion, and with that discussion and that social interaction, I think definitely motivates you a lot more and, like I said, is sort of makes you personally invested in relating to the material on a more intimate level.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was after that class that I decided that would be my major.
Yeah.
And, here I am.
Look at
I'm
that.
A philosophy major today.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And I think it has only done, wonderful things because, I've cultivated, definitely more appreciation for learning and just, I've sort of approached my whole education differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, it's a different way to look at it than being in high school and doing what you have to do.
Right.
But now that I'm, given, hey, you can do this, try this, try that, it's only now that I've sort of become really into my education.
Yeah. It just in my own experience, I think one point I wanted to make was that it wasn't at school that I got that exposure. I mean, it was at home for me, and Dad, if you're listening, I give you props. You're the one who gave me the books. And I remember a teacher in high school gave me, a young adult book, and I read it in, 2 days, and I was like, what is this crap? This isn't real. My dad gave, and it's that standard, and he held that standard high, and that's what that exposure to what I consider to be good writing, good literature, made all the difference, and as opposed to bad writing, and I don't know what kids are reading, but I was so anxious to get to that good writing and to find it and to read. I remember thinking as a kid, I want to read adult books, whatever that means as a kid. You get my drift, right?
Well, yeah, and it just goes back to kids always, always trying to act like adults.
Right.
And it's again, once you get the chance, you want to do something with it.
Right.
Does anybody else have any experiences?
I'd have to agree with you on the philosophy thing and how it's just, enriched our lives and given us a greater appreciation, I guess. And
I'm good in bed.
Well, yeah, definitely. But, I think that philosophy is definitely something that should be taught at a younger age because just in the past 2 years that I've been taking a lot of philosophy courses, I see that my communication skills have improved, my reading skills, my writing skills. Everything in my life has improved since I've started taking philosophy and, definitely at a younger age.
Yeah, and to go back to that what we talked about earlier, things being too hard or too much. Philosophy doesn't have to be too hard or too much. It absolutely does not have to be. And for high school students especially too, even in some of my classes, teachers would bring in some ideas, but I think that's good. And it goes back to exposure. And go ahead.
Well, I had an English class. I'm not going to mention any names, but I was in it for a half a semester, and I would literally in the class, I know this doesn't say much for me, but I would literally just lay down under my seat, and I would take a nap. And I, and I would quite literally have, this was in high school. I didn't fail to mention that. I believe it was my sophomore year, but either way, this lady, it was just so, I know. But,
not for you, for her.
Yeah, for, okay.
She's doing something wrong.
Yeah, she honestly did not challenge anybody in that class, not a single person. There was kids, literally, who would, I'm not going to say that. I won't go into that. But it was just, it was a terrible class. Nobody was being challenged.
Right.
There was a book report that was due, you know, and that was that all you had to do. And then you had to listen to this lady talk for a while. And I switched out of it, and I went into an honors class. And because I was like, listen, I can't handle this. I need to get out of here. I want to go to a different class. And luckily, they allowed me the flexibility to do that in high school. And I got into this honors class. And one of the first things that we read, I kind of forgot about this till you brought it up, about philosophy, but it was my first encounter with philosophy, and it was reading Plato's Apology.
Awesome.
And, yeah.
Fantastic.
It just totally rocked my world. I was like, yes. Awesome. You know, all of a sudden, like, totally engaged, wanted to come to class, was excited to be there.
Yeah.
I was awake, focused.
Yeah.
And I remember asking one of the kids in the other classes, in the class that I was in prior, and I said, so, you know, what are you guys doing? And, oh, well, we have to make a bookmark for this thing, and then we have to talk about why our bookmark represents the book that we're reading.
Right.
And I was just like, wow, like, so glad I didn't do that, because that's just an absolute waste of my time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, like, what specific things was that teacher doing differently? I mean, introducing Plato's Republic, but can you remember anything else? I mean, was... Obviously, if you're reading Plato's Republic, I'm going to guess there's probably a lot more dialogue going on.
It was Plato's Apology, and I actually regret missing the first semester of that, which he devoted a lot to grammatical structure of putting together sentences and things, which I still feel that high school should have put more, or at least helped me out with more.
But
there was a lot more dialogue. I think there was also an expectation that was higher. He looked at you and he said, you know, you guys are old enough. Like, here it is. Here's the information. Like, you know, and you wanted to come prepared to class because you knew that people were going to be talking about what was going on. And, you know, you could either sit there and not pay attention, or you could be engaged and, you know, and actually engage yourself and be able to come up with your own things.
What I think is probably the worst part of what you just said is that that was an honors class. Those opportunities are offered to honors students and not...
Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of kids in high school, they can take the honors class, but they choose not to because they think it'll be too hard.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, obviously these opportunities should be offered to everybody, not just the kids that decide to take the honors classes.
Yeah.
Right. Shouldn't they all be honors classes?
Right.
Yeah. Because I didn't think that honors classes were harder in high school.
No.
I thought that they were actually a little bit easier because you wanted
You're
to go. It wasn't painful to go to that class, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You had a passion for it.
Right. Or they should just, more students should be encouraged to take it. I felt like, I feel like I was almost discouraged to take honors classes.
Well, and
in
some
way,
of them,
like,
I remember you had a test in.
Yeah.
You know, like we said earlier, tests do not measure your ability.
Yeah.
Well, that just makes me think more, you know, like, to bring up GPA and, you know, GRE scores, LSAT scores. Everybody stresses out about those.
Right.
And it's almost like it becomes, I don't know, like it sort of defines who you are as a person, your score.
It's like your number.
Yeah. It's like all of a sudden I'm reduced to a number. You know, it makes me think, like, how well does that really portray the student behind the number? Because it doesn't, I mean, it seems like, you know, students should be looked at on a more holistic level. I mean, and I know I'm not speaking for every, you know, just to use the example of a graduate school, I'm sure not all graduate schools admit just solely based on a score and maybe do look on a more holistic level, but it just, I don't know, it just triggered the thought that, you know, that score is just...
It's almost as if, I guess I kind of was thinking with Karl Marx in mind, but it has this same idea with kind of money, how it alienates these grades and scores that you get actually alienate you from your knowledge and from what your capacity is, because it quantifies it, it puts a limit on it, it has a bar, which I think it's good to be able to say, hey, like, this is where I'm at. But not to say that this is where I can only be, you know.
Right, like
and
a plateau.
Right.
And just think about the anxiety that is wasted over this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Wasted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you spend the weeks prior to the ACTs just busting ass trying to get that you know, 30 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, afterwards you get, like, a 26 and you just feel like crap,
yeah.
You know. And it's just wasted.
Good. What are you talking about?
When you were aiming for a 30 or whatever. I mean, I didn't
right.
do well on the ACT.
No. And that really takes away from self-esteem. I remember when I took the GREs, actually, I think that's a better example because I studied so hard and still, like, I did okay, but it takes away from your self-esteem.
It does.
And that's the thing. It's so inhumane.
And
you leave with your head hanging down. Like.
Even if you have the idea
yeah.
and you have the
right.
values that this doesn't matter, you
right.
still, you walk out of there thinking they think it matters.
Right, right.
And I don't think it matters,
right.
but they're judging me
right.
on this. It's
right.
not fair.
Right.
And I think it is important to hold the bar high for yourself.
Yeah.
But I think that at the same time, like, how can you measure one person's success as a student or their
mm-hmm.
engagement in their own education and learning
right.
by one number?
Right.
It just doesn't
mm-hmm.
seem to do
yeah.
a person justice.
It doesn't.
It's that
it
educational
doesn't.
Bottom line that this article talks about, and it seems like it's easier at the administrative level, it's easier to deal with numbers. It is.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is wrong.
Well, go ahead.
No,
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to mention, just going back to the No Child Left Behind.
That's exactly
I know that
what I was saying. It's like the main criticism.
It really
one of the
is.
Main criticisms
yeah, really
of
is.
No Child Left
mm-hmm.
Behind.
But schools that have higher test scores get more money, which
huh.
seems backwards.
Yeah.
So backwards.
Yeah.
So, you know, the schools are pushing for this.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, and, you know, they always say it encourages the teacher to
mm-hmm.
teach to the test. They
yeah,
always say.
Exactly.
Because, you know, you're not only putting the pressure on the student
mm-hmm.
to measure up and get a certain
mm-hmm.
score, but you're also putting the pressure on the teacher. And maybe, like, it's an unrealistic goal.
Right.
Yeah,
because not every classroom dynamic is the same. Not every individual
right.
student learns
right.
the same. And I think that, and this is just an opinion, that by allowing the teacher a little more creativity and maybe not
right.
putting so much pressure on this test as a result, that they can sort of adjust given the different dynamic of each individual classroom
mm-hmm.
and each individual student.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and going along with that, though, I mean, yes, I think there, you know, you have to test somehow the information
right.
that's attained.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
I definitely think there's another score that's involved here that is, you know, even more important, and that's the affective, like, processes and
yeah.
how those are coming along, and some sort of test towards that, I think,
right.
would be highly beneficial, you know, like maybe a report from the parents, you know,
yeah.
like, how is my kid, how is your kid operating, you know, at home prior to this experience and now after, you know, is
yeah.
there any improvement, is there any at-home interest
yeah.
levels?
Yeah. Well, we have about 7 minutes left, and what I did want to get to is we've been giving a lot of criticism, positive, constructive criticisms, but I really wanted to kind of talk about where are we going and what's our job as students and how can we help this, what can we do, what should be done, what ought to be done in education and amongst ourselves. So,
I think number one, and I've been trying to do this, but it takes some courage to. And what I was going to say is that afterwards, you go to your teacher at their office hours, whatever,
yeah.
or send them an email
mm-hmm.
and give them a firsthand experience,
yeah,
like, of
sure.
what you experienced. Be
right.
like, listen, this is from sitting in my chair,
mm-hmm.
this is what I got.
Yeah.
You know, and they can take
yeah.
it however they want to,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's important to at least
mm-hmm.
get your voice heard. And
yeah.
I think that's a lot of the problem is
right.
people are unwilling to let their voice be heard.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, giving the teacher feedback.
Yeah.
on your personal
yeah.
experience in class. Would you say that most teachers want feedback?
The good ones.
Oh, I
yeah.
The good ones.
Just
sure.
a personal story. A couple weeks ago, I actually went in and gave feedback to a professor, and I said, I am not enjoying this class. I'm sorry, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not enjoying this. And she was very receptive
mm-hmm.
to it and worked with me to figure
mm-hmm.
out a way that I could enjoy it.
Yeah.
And she, at the end of it, she said, thank you so much for coming in.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate this. You know,
yeah,
and
that's a
it'll
teacher.
Help her in the future.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but on the other side, on the other hand, it seems like it would only take one time for you to get totally shot down by someone. You
oh,
know,
yeah.
say
right.
you make a point to go to a teacher
mm-hmm.
and pour your heart out. I'm just not getting it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you make that effort, and you get shot down or discouraged, completely discouraged. I mean, will you ever recover and do it again?
That happened to me in a math class, and I have not recovered from math.
That's like reality. Not all teachers are going to be as receptive as the one that you came across. I personally don't think all teachers want feedback.
Yeah. Well, and then what do we do with the young kids who don't have the voice to go to their teacher? I mean, like, think about a 10-year-old. Who's hating class and doesn't realize that, you know, he or she can go to the teacher. What do we do about them? There's got to be somebody that can say something.
I mean, a parent, if it's a good parent, if they're aware of what's going on in their child's life, you would hope. But, and you'd also hope that the kind of people in the educational system are striving towards that. I know that's not always the case, but I'm hoping that more and more teachers become aware. And I know I've had the professor say this to me, teachers often forget what it's like to be a student. And that's huge. I think that's so huge because when you're in that position of power for so long, you forget how the kind of stress and the kind of anxiety that goes into learning something new. And especially for a child, because it doesn't come easy for everyone. And we're kind of hard on those people who don't get it right away. And it's hard to be sympathetic when you've been teaching it for so long.
Mm-hmm. So, I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
And I think it takes a lot of insight. And it really just depends. Again, it just really depends on the teacher. Mm-hmm. Not everybody is able to think that way.
Yeah.
Well, one of the... You know, and I don't have the citation on hand, but it was a podcast. I believe if you type in education and democracy, it will come up probably with a high relevance bar if you have iTunes. But this was a teacher in Chicago who basically was in this really, really bad school, and he asked the entire year, all the kids did were they talked about what they needed to do to make their school experience better. And they're actually like really engaged with the community. They got national recognition and results started to happen. And I think that kids don't know that their voice is powerful. And so maybe some kind of organization that like allows like kids a medium to communicate through, you know, I think a lot of younger kids given the opportunity to be like, hey, like, listen, like you want to be involved, like you can change what's going on in your school. Like, you know, talk to us, talk to this, you know, whatever. And, you know, whether it's, you know, the sinks are overflowing in the bathroom or, you know.
Toilets won't flush.
Yeah, or I got this, you know, whatever. It could be any number of things.
Right.
But,
and that voice is powerful. And the student's voice is powerful. And it should be heard.
I was going to go back real quick to the whole idea of children and play. And I got a John Locke, an essay concerning human understanding. In book two of The Ideas, he talks about where ideas come from, namely sensation and reflection. And he says reflection comes later. And reflection is being able to understand the faculties of the mind. He lists them perception, thinking, doubting, believing, reasoning, knowing, willing. And I don't know that, you know, he's saying this comes later, and by play, kids get to realize that they have these faculties, and it's, I imagine it being quite an empowering thing to be able to know that you are this agent that can do all these things and capable of these things, rather than being totally unconscious of it, and I just think that it's really cool that there's research out there now that's in favor of this, and there is going to... And hopefully there will be some serious reforms in education because there's some great opportunity out there.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely think this conversation may deserve a further episode.
A further episode,
oh, I
agree. You're definitely
so anybody who's listening, if you really find this topic interesting, we're willing to consider sort of an extended episode or a second episode to this content because we personally find it very interesting.
All right. Well, thank you. For listening. We will be here next week, same time, and visit our website, ethicstalk.cmish.edu, and please give us more ideas on future episodes that we can do. And remember, students, you are powerful, and teachers, you be creative. Inspire your students. All right, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.